It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch, Rob Nichols, Jill Prowse, and a host of points to ponder.
Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. Never Let Me Go is Kazuo Ishiguro's sixth novel, and arguably his most popular. Set in a seemingly idyllic country boarding school, the story follows a group of students as they complete their education and look towards their futures. It is narrated by Kathy H., and the fact she has no given last name is one of the first of many tiny clues that all is not quite as ordinary as it might appear to be on the surface. Kathy is a carer, and her job is to look after donors, but it is a long way through the book before the exact nature of these roles becomes clear. Life at Hailsham, where Kathy grew up, is the subject of the first half of this novel, and we come to know and care about the students. The children have normal interests and ordinary ambitions, yet they are all aware there is something different about them. They live with a series of guardians who monitor their progress and carefully lead them to an understanding of their role in life. Kathy's special friends are Tommy and his girlfriend Ruth, and most of the story is told through their experiences.
I'm not sure for how long the secret guard business carried on. When Ruth and I discussed it while I was caring for her down in Dover, she claimed it had been just a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, but that was almost certainly wrong. She was probably embarrassed about it, so the whole thing had shrunk in her memory. My guess is that it went on for about 9 months, a year even, around when we were 7 going on 8. I was never sure if Ruth had actually invented the secret guard herself, but there was no doubt she was the leader. There were between 6 and 10 of us, the figure changing whenever Ruth allowed in a new member or expelled someone. We believed Miss Geraldine was the best guard in Hailsham, and we worked on presents to give to her. Large sheet with pressed flowers glued over it comes to mind. But our main reason for existing, of course, was to protect her. By the time I joined the guard, Ruth and the others had already known for ages about the plot to kidnap Miss Geraldine. We were never quite sure who was behind it. We sometimes suspected certain of the senior boys, sometimes boys in our own year. There was a guard we didn't like much, a Miss Eileen, who we thought for a while might be the brains behind it. We didn't know when the abduction would take place, but one thing we felt convinced about was that the woods would come into it. The woods were at the top of the hill that rose behind Hailsham House. All we could see, really, was a dark fringe of trees, but I certainly wasn't the only one of my age to feel their presence day and night. When it got bad, it was like they cast a shadow over the whole of Hailsham. All you had to do was to turn your head or move towards a window and they'd be there, looming in the distance. Safest was the front of the main house because you couldn't see them from any of the windows. Even so, you never really got away from them. There were all kinds of horrible stories about the woods. Once, not so long before we all got to Hailsham, a boy had had a big row with his friends and run off beyond the Hailsham boundaries. His body had been found 2 days later, up in those woods, tied to a tree, with the hands and feet chopped off. Another rumour had it that a girl's ghost wandered through those trees. She'd been a Hailsham student until one day she climbed over a fence just to see what it was like outside. This was a long time before us, when the guardians were much stricter, cruel even, and when she tried to get back in, she wasn't allowed. She kept hanging out around outside the fences, pleading to be let back in, but no one let her. Eventually, she'd gone off somewhere out there. Something had happened and she'd died. But her ghost was always wandering about the woods, gazing over Hailsham, pining to be let back in. The guardians always insisted these stories were nonsense, but then the older students would tell us that was exactly what the guardians had told them when they were younger, and that we'd be told the ghastly truth soon enough, just as they were. The woods played on our imaginations the most after dark, in our dorms as we were trying to fall asleep. You almost thought then you could hear the wind rustling and the branches, and talking about it seemed to only make things worse. I remember one night we were furious with Marge Kay. She'd done something really embarrassing to us during the day. We chose to punish her by hauling her out of bed, holding her face against the window pane and ordering her to look up at the woods. At first, she kept her eyes screwed shut, but we twisted her arms and forced open her eyelids until she saw the distant outline against the moonlit sky, and that was enough to ensure for her a sobbing night of terror.
Like Ishiguro's previous books, Never Let Me Go is beautifully written. The prose is polished and clear, and he manages to convey the darkness of the story without resorting to melodrama or making an issue of it. More than anything else, the novel shows us how powerful language can be, altering our perceptions and influencing our understanding of an issue. By giving the characters the title of donor, he leads us on to the inevitable completion, a term suggesting they've simply finished a job. And in one way they have, for they were created for exactly that. The careful, calm way Ishiguro approaches his subject makes it all the more chilling, for it is that sort of reasoning that has allowed such a project to become accepted in the first place. The students of Hailsham have been very privileged in their upbringing, but that makes no difference to their later lives, and they are not ever considered fully human.
I'd hardly ever been to the Kingsfield in those days, so Ruth and I had to consult the map a number of times on the way, and we still arrived several minutes late. It's not very well appointed as recovery centres go, and if it wasn't for the associations it now has for me, it's not somewhere I'd look forward to visiting. It's out of the way, and it's awkward to get to, and yet, when you're there, there's no real sense of peace and quiet. You can always hear traffic on the big roads beyond the fencing, and there's a general feeling they never properly finish converting the place. A lot of the donors' rooms you can't get to with a wheelchair, or else they're too stuffy or too drafty. There aren't nearly enough bathrooms, and the ones there are hard to keep clean, get freezing in winter and are generally too far from the donors' rooms. The Kingsfield, in other words, falls way short of a place like Ruth's centre in Dover, with its gleaming tiles and double-glazed windows that seal at the twist of a handle. Later on, after the Kingsfield became the familiar and precious place it did, I was in one of the admin buildings and came across a framed black-and-white photo of the place, the way it was before it was converted, when it was still a holiday camp for ordinary families. The picture was probably taken in the late 50s or early 60s and showed a big rectangular swimming pool with all these happy people, children, parents, splashing about, having a great time. It's concrete all around the pool, but people have set up deck chairs and some lounges and they've got large parasols to keep them in the shade. When I first saw this, it took me a while to realise I was looking at what the donors now call the square, the place where you drive in, where you first arrive at the centre. Of course, the pool's filled in now, but the outline's still there, and they've left standing at one end, an example of this unfinished atmosphere, the metal frame for the high diving board. It was only when I saw the photo it occurred to me that what the frame was and why it was there, and today, each time I see it, I can't help picturing a swimmer taking a dive off the top, only to crash into the cement. I might not have easily recognised the square in the photo, except for the white bunker, like two-storey buildings in the background, on all three visible sides of the pool area. That must have been where the families had their holiday apartments, and though I'd guess the interiors have changed a lot, the outsides look much the same. In some ways, I suppose, the square isn't so different to what the pool was back then. It's the social hub of the place, where donors come out of their rooms for a bit of air and a chat. There were a few wooden picnic benches around the square, but especially when the sun's too hot or it's raining, the donors prefer to gather under the overhanging flat roof of the recreation hall at the far end, behind the old diving board frame. That afternoon, Ruth and I went to the Kingsfield. It was overcast and a bit chilly, and as we drove into the square, it was deserted except for a group of six or seven shadowy figures under that roof. As I brought the car to a stop somewhere over the old pool, which, of course, I didn't know about then, one figure detached itself from the group and came towards us, and I saw it was Tommy. He had on a faded green tracksuit top and looked about stone heavier than when I last seen him.
Whilst this novel can be considered one of the great dystopian books of our time, and certainly can be placed alongside Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale and P.D. James's Children of Men, the sci-fi element is less apparent than in most similar works. It is also a story about memory and childhood, and it asks important questions about how society creates others, disadvantaged groups that are seen as less valuable or worthy than the mainstream, and therefore open to exploitation. These points are never laboured or even directly articulated, but are more powerful as a consequence. The slow unfolding of the children's fate, their loss of one another, and Kathy H.'s final acceptance of her own donations will stay with the reader for many days after the book is finished.
Jenny Finch, author, creator of The Drowners and Death of the Elver Man, and general Renaissance woman, your host for the Book of the Month.
In today's crowded world, it's sometimes hard to get heard. And sometimes you need a little extra push to be heard. That's where Manila PR can help. We specialise in online radio and press for independent bands, with prices to match, and have been doing so for the last decade. So if you have a noise to make, make it with Manila. Visit ManilaPR.com now.
Parkville is a purpose-built residential care centre situated at the heart of Middlesbrough and providing personalised care in a modern and homely environment. Parkville aims to help older people to continue to live independent and active lives within the wider community whilst benefiting from the care and support of an experienced and dedicated team of nursing and care staff. At Parkville, we provide facilities to accommodate residential elderly and residential EMI service users. To find out more, please telephone 01642 223334. That's 01642 223334. Parkville Care Centre. Care to call us home.
Strokes affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. Here's a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium, 225 grams of magnesium, 3 grams of
magnesium. Hang on. I've got a pen.
Remember, any more than one tablespoon could kill you. Any less than one tablespoon could kill you.
Right, what was
and
the recipe?
That's the recipe.
Oh,
if
damn.
You would like a more simple solution, oh, then right. You can always call Pharma Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Pharma Nord, I wonder?
pharmanord.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Pharma Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
You're listening to a Southside Broadcasting podcast. Southside Broadcasting is a media company which aims to provide a wide range of features from the rural, health and lifestyle worlds. You can regularly listen to entertaining podcasts with interviews and correspondents from Los Angeles, Nashville, New York and London. You can take part in our Book of the Month features, grab some great nutritional advice, enjoy broadcasts from the Great Yorkshire Show, the Lincolnshire Show, and enjoy local football reviews with our regular feature, Fly Me to the Moon. You can even hear a BAFTA award-winning director drive a train full of teddy bears. You can listen to these and many more podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. For further information on how you can join over 35,000 people who regularly download our podcasts, call us on 01642 854 742 or email info@southsidebroadcasting.com now.
Lincoln Inspired is more than just an arts festival, more than a literary festival, more than a whole set of lifestyle opportunities, and more than what the world has needed for millennia.
To see just how much more Lincoln Inspired can make you, Go to lincolninspired.co.uk and explore the inspiration.
Book of the month on Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com. Probably the best download decision you'll ever make.
Exactly. Word is spreading out there, even as we compile another book of the month, which is, of course, Kazuo Ishiguro, as we heard there, expertly described and articulated as ever by ace writer Jenny Finch. Jenny, of course, with us in a few seconds' time. We have Sue Rice in the studio, whose dulcet tones we actually heard doing the readings for Never Let Me Go. Well done, Sue.
Well, I very much enjoyed reading those excerpts. They were very nice.
Excellent. We'll come to you in a few moments, because you're fulfilling the role of somebody who hasn't as yet read the full text as yet.
Yeah, I'm a newbie to
a
it.
A newbie, exactly. Yes. But somebody who actually was excited to say, oh, is that what you're doing? And when he saw the book in the studio, I think in week one of his placement with us, is Sam Bradley from the University of Teesside. Sam, you were quite excited when you saw that Never Let Me Go was indeed going to be our book of the month for September.
I was. It's one of the 10-12 books I've read in the past 10 years, so, and I really enjoy it, so I'm happy that it's something I can actually help with.
And you've read it twice?
I have read it twice. And seen the film twice,
etc. So, shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Share with us, what are your thoughts? Do you agree with Jenny? Do you think, yeah, it's right? Or do you think, no, I'm never going to go back to that again?
I think Jenny's bang on with what she said. I think it is very well written. It does share a lot of questions and issues that we need to think about society. I think the characters are well developed. I think we actually feel a lot for their process and the fact that they're ultimately going to die, which is for a good cause, but should they have to do that? That's the sort of question you ask from this sort of book.
Jenny made a point about it being in the Margaret Atwood realm of it is science fiction, really, but it's claimed not to be science fiction. You didn't think it was science fiction. Why was that?
I think it is, but it's subtle. It's not trying to do anything that isn't within the realms of possibility, because this sort of thing could happen theoretically, but it is science fiction in terms that it doesn't in real life, but the realistic nature of the book and the possibility is there for it to happen. So it is sci-fi, but it's extremely subtle.
Time magazine defined it as a page-turner and a heartbreaker, a tour de force of knotted tension and buried anguish. From what you read, sir, if we just turn the microphone slightly to yourself, is it the sort of text which you think, yes, actually I want to find out more about this? I mean, Remains of the Day is probably the most famous Ishiguro novel that he's produced beforehand. Mm. And for a writer who's not English or British from that perspective, and is obviously writing from the overseas perspective, he does seem to capture that sense of quintessential English or Britishness.
Mm, I mean, certainly the craft of the imagery from the excerpt that I've read, I was starting to think, oh yes, I would really like to read on. In fact, I was almost disappointed that there was the little X that stopped me from reading further. Certainly the notion of the donors has got me really intrigued. I will most likely be picking that up after I've finished my master's dissertation. I will most certainly be picking it up. I think it looks like the sort of story that's very accessible, but it's also much deeper than maybe it first appears. And I think, you know, if you give it some thought and some credence to the ideas in it, I think it sounds a fascinating book.
Jenny, we were last speaking about Alan Sillitoe, of course, with Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. It's the wonderful Book Corner in Saltburn, a podcast which, of course, is still available for download. Let's face it, there are not many Sillitoe fans out there. It's not doing as well as, obviously, some of our other sort of Book of the Month podcasts are doing. You know, get out there if you support Sillitoe, which
I think on that basis.
But allowing for that, and clearly other writers that we focus on, Sarah Waters springs to mind, plus, of course, the creator of Bosch, Harry Bosch, he is sort of there. How do you think? Because I did feel, again, I come back to the register in which the writer takes to ensure that the reader really sees a kind of public school, boarding school education, which is very much there, which is something which still exists quite manifestly. You know, I can almost sort of sense aspects of my own sort of background. And I think you said when we spoke beforehand that you kind of could recognise some of the measured descriptions that were given.
Yes, I spent one term in a boarding house at one school because my parents moved, and it was very, very familiar. It's interesting the point that you made about someone from another culture is able to describe the English, particularly the English way of life, so perfectly. It was a point that my tutor made at Teesside where she said, it takes an outsider with a good eye to truly see something. If you're born into it and grow up with it, it's almost impossible to be objective about it. And the best writers have come, are very familiar with what they write about, but have come from outside.
Which almost seems to be contrary to the accepted wisdom that's often churned out that writers should write about what they've personally experienced, as opposed to that distanciation effect, to use a kind of Brecht term, where you sort of step outside and you kind of select things and then describe them.
You can personally experience it. I write about the Somerset Levels and I lived there for 5 years.
And you're not a murderer.
I'm not a murderer and I'm not from Somerset.
There we
I was
are.
Always an outsider. I have a lot of experiences I've used.
Sam, I know you're not really writing as such as yet, but you're looking to do that as a consumer of the actual text. Because I'm fascinated in terms of why you liked it so much, because it doesn't really seem to have anything that would really resonate with somebody living in Teesside in the 21st century.
It's nothing to do with the area or anything like that. I just think the story itself is absolutely fascinating. I think all the elements together create a really wonderful story that just makes you gripped. I'm not too concerned with where it is or what it's about, but Cazaux did capture British life extremely well, which is probably handy because he did live in London most of his life. But he did capture it really well, and I think I've never been to boarding school. I didn't know what it was about, but I feel as though I have after reading that because I understand completely what it's about. So for me, it just captured what I expected it to, and it was just wonderfully executed.
Have you read Remains of the Day?
I have.
Again, thoughts on that one?
I think that was exceptional. Again, he likes to capture Britishness, doesn't he? And that book is quintessentially I can't even say that word. It's British, let's say. And Anthony Hopkins in the film, who is exactly as I expect Stevens to be. It's just British, and it's really, really, really well executed again.
Jenny, the Washington Post quote was saying it was the best novel that Ishiguro has written since The Remains of the Day. Would you kind of feel, that's appropriate? I mean, are we talking about something here which is almost flawless in its description? Because I felt it lacked a kind of emotional punch for me. I kind of read it and I thought, yes, it's very well done, but it was almost too clinical at times, which I can appreciate kind of resonates with the notion of the text. But really, there wasn't something which you'd say, I felt really heartbroken about that. You know, even the characters of the teachers or the guardians, as they're referred to, they seem to be very... It was almost unemotionally... you could almost sort of say Japanese-esque in manners.
I think it puts together the best of those two cultures. And you get almost to the end, and it's very prosaic, step by step. And then you get about 5 or 6 pages to the end, and suddenly Tommy is talking about the fourth donation and what happens if you don't fully complete at the end of the fourth donation. And it's at that point, I think, where he's suckered you into going, yes, this is awful and this is exploitation and da-da-da-da-da. And then it's like a knife through your heart when they say, and you just go to a back room and there's no carers and there's no pain relief and you just lie there semi-conscious and the donations carry on. I.e., they take you out and cut you to pieces. You want to die on. And that moment, you realise what it's about. You only need that one sucker punch, and it brings it all home.
It's possibly not a novel to be read just before you're considering whether to actually take an organ donor card. but that's a whole other issue, because so many, if we can turn to you once again from the point of view of the ethical perspective. This, as you may have gathered me, without giving spoilers away about the whole thing, the essence is it deals with people who are effectively developed as clones, they're kind of looked after, but ultimately their raison d'etre, the reason for being, is to actually sort of provide spare parts for their original people to actually continue to live. Would you say, yeah, it makes perfect sense, I'd adopt it for Siren FM today?
No, I love literature like this because it brings issues such as that really to the fore and makes you engage with it and really think about the things behind the story. It's not, that's the thing about this particular book, I think, it's not just a story. You could take it on that basic level if you wished, but there's so much more to it. And he's inviting us to think about, well, is that right? Should we be thinking about that? If that situation does exist and things come into place that may potentially make that exist in future, is that a road we should be going down? I love those sorts of books.
we've reached a stage which I know Jenny dislikes intensely and most people would. We try to attempt to quantify the unquantifiable, quantify the qualitative, but I'll come to you first, Sam. Marks out of 10 for Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go.
I'll give it an 8.
An 8 for yourself. Sue, I know you haven't read it as yet, but on the basis of what you've actually heard and the lines, I think you've already intimated you might be looking to read it.
On the basis of what I think it sounds like, I would give it an 8 as well, yes.
I'll stay with an 8. 7.5 to 8. I mean, I think it's well up there. It's first class, but didn't quite sort of lift it into the 9s and 10s for me. Jenny?
I would give it 9 for the depth of its story and the sheer beauty of its writing.
Rob Nichols, in case you're wondering, he was obviously on the initial trailer for the show, is currently counselling Albert Adoma, but that's another story at another time. And if you're following Middlesbrough Football Club, you might find out exactly what it's all about. It's all to do with Bristol City. But next month, which probably will take place in early October, actually, so you have a joy of Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, the book will be what, Jenny?
Right, next month's book is The Five People You Meet in Heaven by Mitch Albom.
It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch and a team of top writing talent.